Hello, podcast listeners. We know podcasts are a great way to catch up on a program that you may have missed on KSJE, and it's provided as a free service of this radio station. But you know, KSJE is now listener-supported, and so while you enjoy this podcast, we hope that you'll also take some time to join KSJE. Become a member today. It's quite easy to do. Just go to our website at ksje.com/support and pick the level of support that best matches your budget. Thanks again for listening. Here's your podcast. Thursday morning here on KSJE, and it's time for our regular visit with local archaeologist Paul Reed, who works for Archaeology Southwest and Salmon Ruins and a bunch of other places as well. Paul is joining us via Skype this morning from exotic Albuquerque, New Mexico. Paul, good morning.
Good morning, Scott.
Thank you for being here. And I guess we should say the reason that you're in Albuquerque is that it's your jumping off point. You're about to travel to the East Coast to appear at a conference later on this week, correct? Maybe let's start talking about that first.
Sure. Yeah. I was invited to present some of our work that we've been doing on the greater Chaco landscape and keeping Chaco safe at a conference of the International Council on Monuments and Sites. It goes by ACOMOS, that's the acronym. And they are a global NGO or nonprofit that works to preserve World Heritage Sites and other places of great importance. So yeah, it's a big group. There's about 10,000 members in 150 countries. So truly international.
Right. Well, interesting. And congratulations again on being invited to go. And I know you know a lot about what you'll be telling them and visiting about, and then this is important stuff, is it not? I mean, this is, again, when we always talk about Chaco Canyon, I think we kind of take it for granted because it's in our own backyard, but it is a World Heritage Site, and it's worthy of a lot of notice from the rest of the world and all these protections that we'll be talking about, too, this morning. This is what gets it on other people's radar, correct?
Right, it definitely is. And you know, we are really blessed in New Mexico because we have three World Heritage Sites. We have Chaco Canyon, right. We have the Pueblo of Taos, and we have Carlsbad Caverns. There's only 22 World Heritage Sites in the entire U.S., so we really, as New Mexicans, should be quite proud of that. And yeah, this is an opportunity to, you know, sort of continue to keep Chaco Canyon and its importance and protection issues in the eye of a larger public, and especially in a place like Washington, D.C. You know, it's just New Mexico locals don't get out to very often, but
right.
It's a good opportunity to just help folks understand how important Chaco was. In the session that I'm in, they're also going to be talking about the amazing site that's just outside St. Louis, the site of Cahokia, which is, you know, a lot of people are thinking about now as our first city, really.
Right.
And in the, you know, the U.S., the current boundaries of the U.S., the lower 48, you know, that's an amazing complex that developed about the same time as Chaco, which is interesting. You know, no connections between them, but, you know, it's a very interesting place.
But
so,
the
yeah,
timeline,
it's a great opportunity to connect with a larger audience.
Yeah, and the timeline is the same, though, as these cities or gathering places grew, right? And this one is bigger than Chaco, is it not? The estimated population in the St. Louis area?
Yeah, Cahokia was really huge, is a word that, you know, I don't want to throw around lightly, but
right.
The estimates are, you know, 30,000 people in a fairly small area, and then a hinterland, if you will, well over 100,000, you know, going out into four or five current U.S. states. So, yeah, that was really the center of a large place, and, you know, a probably larger population than we had in the ancient Pueblo Southwest, but
right.
Yeah. Very interesting in its own right.
Indeed. And then, of course, with this conference, Paul Reed, I mean, and no offense to my East Coast friends, but, I mean, sometimes folks who are in Washington, D.C. or other places just maybe don't get the Southwest and all these ancient places that we have here and worthy of study and things like that just because they don't run into them very often on the East Coast. We've talked about the reasons why, even though they had populations there around the same time, but just the environment is different.
Right, exactly. I mean, you know, our urban population centers on the East and West Coast tend to have different concerns, certainly in the modern world and as we look into the past, you know, they map onto different things. And I think in some ways, you know, sort of post-European contact, archaeology and history probably has a stronger role in these areas on the East Coast, although there certainly is amazing indigenous, you know, pre-European contact areas. So it is very important for us Westerners to, you know, get on our horses or trains or planes and and make the journey east to help people understand the importance of, you know, these ancient landscapes. You know, because in the case of Chaco Canyon, of course, we have a largely intact landscape at this point. We've certainly had impacts of a variety of, you know, variety of natures.
Sure.
But you drive out to Chaco, as you well know, and it's a bumpy road, not the easiest place to get to. And one of the magical things, of course, about going to Chaco is you feel like you have been transported, not just in space, but in time. So I hope, you know, in a fairly short presentation in D.C. to be able to convey some of that specialness and significance to folks who may never be able to visit.
And who else will be at this conference? This will be others from around the world, Paul Reed, or just North America?
Right. It's an international conference. So this group actually sponsors multiple conferences per year. This one is focused specifically on the social and economic impacts of tourism and, you know, the protection of these World Heritage places. So, you know, this kind of takes us back to the real world, because a lot of times, you know, people who aren't really connected to history and historic preservation and these issues wonder about the benefits of setting these places aside and protecting them. So this conference is really focused on, you know, we're protecting these places, but these are also the benefits in the modern world for people who live in proximity to those, and sort of what the social and economic boosters are, if you will, for communities that step up and say, this is a special place, this is of importance to a local area, to a national area, to a regional area, and worldwide. And here's how we're taking protection of these areas, really, and then promoting responsible tourism and ultimately benefiting the folks who live in proximity to these places. So that's going to be part of the angle for me, is just the impact of tourism to Chaco Canyon, New Mexico, and the Four Corners, and how important that is in our regional economy.
Right. And I know for a lot of maybe international travelers, they seek out these World Heritage sites when they're traveling. It certainly kind of raises things to a whole other level, and they make it a point to go visit these places when they're in an area, and that is what kind of puts us on the map, is having that adjacency to Chaco Canyon and the other places in New Mexico that you mentioned.
Right. It absolutely does. You know, I don't have good percentages, but I know that there's a large percentage of European and Asian visitors in other areas who come and visit Chaco and Mesa Verde and, you know, Solomon and Aztec as well in our immediate backyard. So international tourism is a big part of this. We also have just a lot of folks who drive over from the west or the east and, you know, want to stop by and see. So, you know, the impact of tourism, basically heritage tourism is what we describe it as, on our economy in the Southwest in New Mexico, it is large. And that's something that, you know, we really need to promote more of, because we, in the Four Corners, we really are the gateway to amazing natural and cultural areas. And this is, I think, been partially tapped into, but I think there's more that can be done to bring people out. Yeah.
Well, and it sounds like this conference is talking a little bit about that and much, much more. So, again, good luck, and thank you for representing us so well, as I know you will do. And I want to speak about another topic that relates to both Chaco Canyon and Washington, D.C., and that is the support that a bill to protect Chaco Canyon got from the U.S. House just, what, a week or so ago, 10 days ago?
Right. The House voted last week on Wednesday on you know, H.R. or House Bill 181, I'm sorry, 1181.
Right.
And this one is to protect this zone that we've talked about a couple times on the show that includes a 10-mile area around Chaco and a couple of outlying sites. And this, you know, the bill basically would remove access to the federal subsurface mineral estate for those areas. And really, for those of us in the heritage preservation community, and, you know, certainly many of our tribal partners, this is going to create additional protection for our World Heritage site in Chaco. So, yeah, this really is a nice segue from going to D.C. and talking about what's important about Chaco Canyon and the impacts on our economy, and then how do we protect that, and how do we continue to benefit from, you know, protecting these places.
Right. And, again, I feel I always have to put up the disclaimer that the park boundaries itself are always going to be protected, but this is another kind of a buffer zone, if you will, surrounding the park boundaries that kind of extends now beyond, that would provide more permanent protection. We've kind of seen it more as a piecemeal before this legislation, and still could, I guess, because it's only been passed by the House. It still has a ways to go in D.C., right?
Right, exactly. I mean, it needs to go into the Senate, and that's a different ball game, a different ball of wax.
Right.
We can call it that. You know, and that'll be a process, and it may or may not gain any real traction in the Senate. But, you know, the other thing to point out is this bill is talking simply about the BLM control, the public domain subsurface. So there are going to be many entry points, you know, for responsible oil and gas drilling that remain if this legislation was to get through the House and the Senate and be signed into law. So this is not about shutting off the taps or closing out oil and gas in any respect. What it is about is balancing the need for protection of this area, this vulnerable area, as you mentioned, outside the boundaries of our national park at Chaco, and allowing responsible oil and gas development in other areas. So, you know, that's really part of what we've been doing now for 6 years with Archaeology Southwest and with our partners in the Pueblo and Navajo communities and a whole bunch of other environmental nonprofits and groups, is trying to balance oil and gas with protection of historic places and people living in these areas. So, you know, it's a complicated world, and the land jurisdiction out there, as you know, we call it the checkerboard, because there's 5 or 6 different landowners, major landowners, you know, not to mention the different pieces of private land that are out there. So it's a complicated mosaic, and, you know, but I feel like this legislation is one step towards protecting the areas that, you know, go back 1,000 years, in some cases almost 2,000 years, and
sure,
really are part of our legacy in the Southwest and in the entire country.
Right, and certainly, though, the BLM's holdings is a major chunk of that land, is it not? I mean, I know it's a checkerboard area, but when you talk about the federal lands, that's a pretty large majority, I think, of what we're talking about, the land surrounding the park.
It's about 20%.
Oh, is it just 20%?
Yeah, the roughly 1.5 to 2 million acres, depending, of course, on where you draw those boundaries.
I see.
So the big piece really is Navajo Nation individual allottee, you know, holders, you know. And, you know, those folks really have a variety of different concerns. We've engaged at different points, and a couple of our partners have. But that's part of what makes this really complicated, because the allotments may be held by dozens or even hundreds of people.
Right.
For a single 10, 20, or 50-acre allotment. And so, you know, taking collective action is a challenge, just because you've got to talk to a lot of different people and do that. And there are 2 different allotment associations that are active in the Eastern Agency of the Navajo Nation in that area. You know, and they do a very good job, I think, from what I can tell, advocating for their members and trying to balance as well the economic needs of individual allotment holders with environmental and cultural protections. So, you know, it is, as I said, it's a complicated, you know,
right,
situation. But beginning with the federal lands, you know, seems like a good way to start. And, you know, our state land commissioner, of course, has signed a state land office executive order that will protect about 77,000 acres within, you know, closely proximate 10-mile protection zone around Chaco as well on the state trust land. You know, and they're actively working to figure out if there is any potential lost revenue there, because, of course, our state trust lands produce revenue for our schools at all levels. You know, how to sort of replace some of those funds, you
sure
know, if we have some impacts. But, you know, again, this really is a question of balancing our protection for ancient places that, you know, are not being created anymore. You know, historic sites, archaeological sites, sacred sites to tribes are a non-renewable resource. And just because of our modern society and the paces of development and, you know, the numbers of people we have in our region, you know, these sites are impacted and destroyed by large numbers every year. So being able to balance and protect some of these areas and continue the economic growth and development that we need, you know, is really not an unreasonable prospect. So, and I think, you know, those of us working on different sides of this would put the bar in different places and say, well, let's protect this, let's protect that. So what we've always advocated is just a full discussion with all the stakeholders and some really thoughtful decisions going into this. And I think this piece of legislation will help that process.
Right. Well, and again, this bill that did pass the House seemed to have some bipartisan support, if I'm not mistaken, and certainly had the support of the tribes and other governmental entities in that immediate area. Is that true?
That's right. You know, all of the people identified as Democrats in our U.S. House voted for it, and 17 members of the Republican Party voted for it. So, you know, not an overwhelming bipartisan bill, but certainly support on both sides of
right.
the aisle. And, yeah, all of the Pueblo Council of Governors, individual Pueblos, the Navajo Nation, other tribes, definitely in favor of this legislation. So I think it's a win for everyone. And again, of course, we have to go on to the next step and see how it fares in the Senate and, you know, take that on next. That's part of, for my visit to Washington, D.C., I'm going to be talking with staff and potentially senators, Udall and Heinrich, depending upon schedules, as well as visiting all of our New Mexico congressional reps in the House and thanking them mm-hmm. for their action. And reaching out to a couple of legislators, you know, in different states as well when I'm there.
Sure. And I would imagine that both of New Mexico senators will be supporting this in the Senate when it gets there, and probably working to get maybe some of their other colleagues from the West and elsewhere to pledge their support as well. And any predictions on when that might happen?
It's hard to say. It seems, since we're well into November, that getting this introduced and discussed in the Senate might be a challenge for this year. So we're probably looking at 2020 for that. But right, Tom Udall is the lead sponsor on this bill, and Martin Heinrich as well, our other senator, has signed on. So yeah, I think it'll certainly have broad support from Democrats, and you know, I think probably some Republicans as well. So if it can go through the somewhat complicated and arcane Senate process and actually come up for a vote, I think it would have, you know, a decent chance. But the hurdle seems to be just getting it to the point where it's allowed to be voted on. So
right,
you know,
right,
part of that process.
Exactly. But that's, again, with the vote in the House, it kind of gets it one step further in that direction, it sounds like to me.
Right, and just momentum building for, you know, this being a really good piece of legislation that, you know, a majority seem to think deserves to become law. So,
right,
you know, that's what we're hoping for.
Okay, well, very good. And Paul Reed, what else is on your radar here as you travel across the country talking with folks?
Well, you know, just the continuing range of sort of preservation issues. You know, we tend to be pretty focused on Chaco, but there are other issues as well that come up. You know, there's been a bill introduced in the House to make the Great Men of the Gila in Arizona a national monument.
Right.
So that's something else that I have one Arizona congressional member whose office I'll visit. You know, part of the challenge this week is the House of Representatives did a lot of business in the last couple of weeks, so they're actually in recess for this week. And that's kind of the luck of the draw if
right.
you know, other things get scheduled, and I happen to be going to D.C. this week. So I don't know how many actual members will be available to chat. But, you know, they have very good staffs, all of our representatives, and you know, dedicated young people in most cases who are really focused on the issues and ready to convey messages that they hear from different constituents, sort of up the chain to the members. So, you know, so it's a system that works really well. And for me, this will be my third time going in about 4 years. So I'm starting to have some familiarity. And of course, Washington is an unusual and unique place.
Well, that's true. That's very true.
People have their different opinions on that.
Right.
But, you know, on the prior trips I've made, I've always felt very welcome to be there.
And, good.
You know.
Right.
And I think that I really do feel like our members across the Congress, both sides of the aisle, are always want to hear from people who have concerns. And I think that all of them take that very seriously, that they are there representing all of us.
Sure.
But, you know, and the way we convey the views of people in, you know, rural areas like ours is to go and talk and to send those emails and take the opportunities when town halls come up to engage our politicians. So, you know, that's what we do in this participatory democracy. So
that's true. Well, that's very true. We're getting a civics lesson here this morning, which isn't a bad thing. But do you get frustrated sometimes, though, at the pace of some of this this work that is getting done? I mean, again, and maybe some of your other friends and colleagues, too, that they'd like it done yesterday in our immediate society. But it seems like government takes its sweet time. But every step forward, two steps forward, one step back, but we're still moving in the forward direction.
Right. I think that's generally true on a lot of the issues that we care about. It is a complicated process, but, you know, our country has, what, 335 million people.
Right.
And, you know, we have a Congress of, what, you know, just over 600 people. So, you know, there's a lot of us who have concerns that need to get to the people who are decision makers. And, you know, so again, we have to take advantage of the pathways to do that. And of course, we have to get out and vote when we have the opportunity to vote for people that we feel are going to represent our country in the way that it needs to be represented. So, and that's a responsibility and really an obligation and an honor for all of us to have that role.
That's
so once
true.
We voted, then I think we have to continue to put in the effort to talk to our politicians, let them know how we feel. Because if we're just, you know, if we're just complaining on Facebook groups or with our small circles in whatever community, you know, sometimes it's very satisfying to vent. And, you know, there are frustrations when things don't seem to move forward. But we are lucky in this country compared to other areas to have relatively easy access to leaders at different levels and the ability to sit down and talk with most of those people. And, you know, it's not always on the first try, so persistence helps.
True.
But I would encourage people to do that and to really express their views. Because I think, again, our leadership at all levels really is interested in hearing from the people that they have chosen to represent. That's their job. That's their first job.
Right. Well, I think that's very true, Paul Reed. And again, I think it's important. We just had an election earlier this week, and I think folks were reminded again how important it is to get out and vote even in an off year. Some important decisions and representations were being selected in that election. So we are out of time for this month, Paul Reed, but again, safe travels to you, and thank you for representing us in D.C., and we look forward to hearing how it went maybe next month.
Yeah, that'd be great, Scott, I'm sorry. As always, great to be on your show. And, I will return with tales of some sort.
Okay. All right. Well, very good. Well, just watch your step when you're in D.C., but we'll see you when you get back. Thank you, Paul Reed, very much.
Thank you, Scott.
You're welcome. That is archaeologist Paul Reed from Archaeology Southwest and Salmon Ruins, my guest here on KSJE. Did you enjoy that podcast? We hope that you did. And if you did, share it with your friends. And if you really want to keep podcasts like this coming, please support KSJE. You can do it easily online at ksje.com.